Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. In this week's podcast, are we alone in the universe?
For most of a day, we thought that that really could be ET.
Well, we've got the one person on this planet who probably knows more about this than anyone else.
We're not looking for certain patterns. We're not looking for the Fibonacci series or anything like that.
And if the aliens do try to get in touch, how will we know what they look and sound like?
If you can understand them, then suddenly you're exposed to this very advanced knowledge. I mean, imagine you're a university academic. You've been researching some subject for, 50 years, and these guys come in and say, oh, we solved that problem, 50,000 years ago. Here, you may want to read some of our papers.
Let's go hunt some ETs. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Well, another bite-sized holiday edition of the podcast this week. Now, some of you might think we're being a bit lazy. Instead of a full time-consuming review of the year, we're just going to do this interview, which is so interesting, we think you should listen to it in full. 24 hours a day, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence based in California, is scanning the skies for things not of this Earth. The theory behind it is that given a suitable environment and sufficient time, life will develop on other planets. SETI seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. Now, this isn't just a bonkers-sounding experiment. It's been going on for years, since 1994, in fact. The US government contributed to earlier SETI projects, but recent work has mainly been funded by private sources. SETI's senior astronomer is Seth Shostak. I suppose you could call him the world's leading alien hunter. We managed to get him into our London studios for an enlightening chinwag.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Seth, in 2003, you predicted that we'd find aliens by 2025. Do you still think that's true?
Well, I do bet people a cup of coffee about that, Alok, because I am somewhat sanguine. I do think that there's a good chance we'll find somebody in the next 24 years. Now, mind you, that prediction was predicated on the completion of some new instruments, a new radio telescope that would greatly speed up the search. And to some extent, that's driven by the money. If you can't get the money to build it, that might affect my prediction somewhat. But I'll buy you a cup of coffee if we haven't found them by 2025.
Thanks. But I mean, the idea is that to find alien signals sort of floating around in space, you reckon there's two things. One is how many alien species there might be out there. And the second is how quickly we're scanning the sky. On those two fronts, how on earth do you, I mean, on the first front, how do you work out a number like how many alien species there are out there?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. I mean, that's how I could make this prediction, such as it is. I mean, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. So in order to know when you might trip across a needle, you ask yourself, okay, well, how big is the haystack? How many needles are in there? And how fast am I going through the hay? So your first question, how do you know how many needles are out there? In other words, how many societies are broadcasting signals that are going through our bodies, as we sit here? We don't know the answer to that. Those are just guesses. But what I did was I sort of look at the range of guesses that have been made over the past couple of decades, including those by Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, Frank Drake. These are all people that have, scientists who have thought about these problems. And they have a range of guesses. And I said, well, if anything in that range is correct, let's assume anything in that range is correct, that the correct number is somewhere in there, then I can figure out when we'll find them on the basis of technology, because technology tells you how fast you're going through the hay looking for needles.
Now, that you mentioned Frank Drake. Now, his equation is the sort of famous one that people use to try and predict how many life species there might be out there. And this has a whole bunch of factors, including number of worlds, sustainable worlds for worlds with water, etc. Just take us through what that equation is.
Yeah, well, this is an equation Frank came up with in 1961, which was 1 year after he had done the pioneering SETI experiment. That was 1960. He used an antenna in West Virginia, and he pointed at a couple of nearby stars for just a couple of weeks, hoping to eavesdrop on ET. He didn't hear ET. He did hear the U.S. military, but that didn't count. But there was so much interest was ginned up by this little experiment that the next year he had a small conference with about a dozen people, and as an agenda for the conference to discuss how we might look for cosmic company, he concocted this little formula, which is now known as the Drake equation, which gives you a number n. And n is simply the number of transmitting civilizations in our galaxy. And clearly, that just depends on how many stars are out there, what fraction of them have planets, what fraction of those planets are somewhat like the Earth, so they could spawn, complex life, how many of them actually have produced life, how many of those have produced intelligent life. These are all factors in the equation. And toward the end there, the factor of probably the greatest uncertainty comes into play, and that is once you have an intelligent species that's able to build a radio transmitter, so you might have a chance of hearing them, how long do they last before they go off the air for whatever reason? So that's the Drake equation.
So we've had radio transmitters only for a couple of hundred years.
Not even that.
And if climate change does what it does, then we're going to be disappearing in a few hundred years. So we've not got a massive window. Okay, well, that's one side of the equation, which is the number of species out there or number of worlds. The other side is how quickly are we scanning this? And this is where the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, comes in. Now, let's get to the bottom of this. SETI is not an institute that believes that aliens are here right now and is some sort of conspiracy theory thing. This is a serious scientific institute.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, the belief in UFOs that, you know, that we're being visited, that's taken seriously by roughly a third of the population of the UK. So I wouldn't dismiss them all as unserious people. But I don't think, I agree with you. I don't think that the evidence is very good. And in fact, if I thought the evidence were good, why would we bother with all these radio telescopes and all this very expensive equipment? Of course, we would start looking, you know, in Clapham Junction for the aliens or something like that.
I've seen some, I'm sure. Yeah. So SETI is looking specifically for radio signals into space. And I mean, how like I said, how quickly is this happening? How much of the sky do you monitor at a certain time?
Well, historically, it's been very slow. In other words, we've had to use other people's antennas. That is, say, antennas that were really built for radio astronomy, not for looking for ET. And these are very nice antennas. They're usually very big. They have sophisticated receiving systems and so forth and so on. But on the other hand, you only get to use them for maybe a couple of weeks a year, typically. And so that's like trying to do medical research, but always having to go next door and borrowing a microscope from somebody, and you only get to use it a few hours a week. So that's very slow. And what would happen is you would look in the direction of, say, some nearby star, on the assumption that it might have some planets, maybe some of them inhabited, and you would sort of scan the dial. That might take you hours or days to scan through a whole bunch of frequencies looking for a signal that would tell you somebody's there. And then the next day you do another star, or you know, you do two a day or something like that. Very slow. But if you look at what's happened historically, the experiment has sped up simply because of the march of technology. And in fact, the speed up has followed something called Moore's Law, which is just a law of the Silicon Valley where I live, which says that computing power per dollar or per pound doubles every 18 months. SETI has sped up by a factor of two every 18 months ever since that first experiment a half century ago. So, you know, you're going through the hay faster and faster all the time.
Now, what you're looking for is some sort of electrical signal that is different to the noise which is probably being heard all day long, all night long. I'm assuming so far we haven't had that signal, but what would it look like if you saw something which... It was interesting.
Yeah, well, it's true. I'm going to level with you here, Alec. We have not found ET, not yet. And if we had...
You wouldn't tell us, would you?
Come on.
We'll come on to that later.
No, I would be on my way to Stockholm to collect a big prize and a not immodest check. But, in fact, no, we haven't heard anything yet. But indeed, we look for, actually, the kind of signal we look for what are called narrowband signals. This is just the kind of signal that transmitters make, and the natural noise makers of the universe don't make. There are a lot of, you know, sources of radio static out there, quasars and pulsars and many, many other things. And we have to sort out the thing we're looking for from them. But we're not looking for certain patterns. We're not looking for the Fibonacci series or anything like that.
So no messages or anything like that?
Well, I mean, presumably there would be a message. It's hard for me to believe, although who knows, that ET would mount a massive transmitting project but not put any information on it. I mean, that sounds like the BBC is going to broadcast the hum from their desk lamps for the next 10,000 years. Hard to believe. I'm sure they would send a message. But our first priority is find the on-the-air sign. And then we'll go back and look for the message.
Okay. And so this kind of assumes, of course, that they've got the same kind of transmitter technology that we have, or that they're doing the same sorts of things. I mean, this is just, are you just assuming that they're sort of following the same sort of communications paths that we've developed over the years?
You sort of are compelled to do that. It's, in a sense, it's somewhat provincial, because indeed we're sort of assuming they're a little bit like us, at least in terms of their technological expertise. But, you know, and I get emails every day from people who say, well, you guys are wasting your time. Why don't you look for subspace communications a la Star Trek, or maybe something that's hyperdimensional physics or what? I mean, these are all nifty words, but if you don't know any of the, you know, physics involved, any of the science involved in those terms, you're kind of hard put to design an experiment. So indeed, we look for radio waves. We also look, by the way, for flashing lights. If they're if they've got some big lasers aimed our way and they're, you know, trying to get our attention the way the cowboys used to do in the old movies with their shaving mirrors, we might pick that up too.
So what is the closest you've ever come to? What sort of stopped your heart for a second?
Close. I mean, there's no close here, you know, right? Either you found them or you haven't found them.
There must be some time when you think, okay, this could be it. Oh, no, it isn't.
Yes, that does happen. Actually, you pick up signals all the time, of course. I mean, we've got a receiver that's monitoring typically 50, 100 million channels at once on a big antenna. Of course, you pick up signals all the time. And, you know, we check them all out, and so far they've all been due to, you know, radars down at the local airport or telecommunications satellites, things like that. Actually, I have a book out called Confessions of an Alien Hunter, and I begin the book with a signal that we picked up in 1997, so a dozen years ago, more or less. And for most of a day, we thought that that really could be ET. And so that was very interesting because it showed us what would really happen if we were to succeed with this experiment. I mean, it was no longer speculation about whether the men in black would show up. We actually saw what would happen because we thought this might be it.
So this false alarm, what was it in the end?
Do you have a need to know, Alec?
I don't know. Am I cleared? I don't know.
It was the SOHO research satellite, which is a European satellite designed to study the sun. And the signal was bouncing around the steelwork of our antennas in just the right way to mimic ET. So once again, it was the fault of the Europeans.
Okay. So when you're sort of doing these experiments, do you have to, because you know, you're a scientist, you don't want to just believe anything that comes out there, but you are hunting for extraterrestrials signals. So do you have to be extra skeptical when you see something that you might think is a signal?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you don't want to cry wolf. That's the bottom line. You don't want to, you know, call up the Guardian and say, by the way, you can run a headline, we found ET. And then 2 days later, you call up and say, well, actually, no, it wasn't ET. It was just a telecommunications satellite. I mean, that would probably, you know, damage your credibility.
If there was a signal, if something did happen, if there was a blip that you confirmed after a couple of days of being skeptical and it came true, then what is the protocol? What happens next? I mean, who gets told? Does the president get told? Does he decide what happens next?
No.
Or do you just bring up newspapers?
Neither one, as it turns out. In fact, I'm the chairman of an international SETI group that is wrestling, as we speak, with this very matter of what are called the protocols. And all this is, it sounds, you know, very menacing, protocols, but it's in fact just a sort of a gentleman's agreement amongst all those who are doing SETI, or at least a large fraction of them, as to what they would do if they found a signal. And it comes down to this. You would verify the signal. In other words, you would keep following that signal across the sky until you were pretty sure that this was really an extraterrestrial transmitter. You would call up people at another observatory and say, would you mind looking at it? I mean, you wouldn't believe it if you were the only ones to find it. So you would do all those checks first. And at that point, you would simply tell the world. And as far as deciding what to do, well, I mean, they're likely to be hundreds, maybe thousands of light years away, Alec. You know, no great rush to grab the microphone and do anything. But I mean, that's a secondary step. In fact, and in practice, and as we found out from these false alarms we've had, what really happens is that you're busy there trying to confirm the signal, which might take you a week, right? It's not like in the movies where you're sitting there looking bored one moment and the next moment, eureka. It doesn't happen that way. It would take days or a week. What actually happens is the media start calling you up.
So I was going to say, you can't hide something like that even for an hour, never mind a week.
No, you can't. Everybody's sending emails to their boyfriends or girlfriends. Hey, Marge, don't tell anybody, but, you know.
Especially what with the internet and with message boards and blogging and tweets and all sorts of things.
Well, we had that a dozen years ago, and actually I described that in the book. You know, we were sitting around thinking this might be the real thing, and at 9 o'clock in the morning, the New York Times started calling me up.
If somehow in the future we do discover that ET exists, what do you think ET might look like? What is the nature of this creature?
Yes, I think that's a good question, actually. I'm not sure that many of my colleagues consider it a particularly interesting question. They say, all we ask of ET is that he can, or she, or it, can build a radio transmitter. And if they can do that, what do we care what their physiognomy is like? I mean, what do they look like? Who cares? But I think it does matter, because I think that the search depends in some sense on whether ET is a soft, squishy kind of biological being, maybe with big gray eyeballs or something. I mean, they always look like us, don't they, in the movies? I mean, they have.
Wouldn't it be
eyes.
Disappointing if they did turn out to be like the ones in the movies?
Because if
our imagination stretches to the universe or something.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's actually a fellow at Cambridge, Simon Conway Morris, who thinks that the aliens might very well look like us, but I'm not sure I agree with that. I honestly think that this is a more likely scenario. You invent radio at some point. You're some alien species. You invent radio, and then within 100, 200 years, you do what we are about to do, which is to say invent our own successors. So you invent thinking machines, right? You know, within 20 years, your laptop computer will have the same computing power as a human brain. Doesn't mean it will think, but maybe shortly thereafter it will. So, you know, within a couple hundred years of inventing radio, then you've invented artificial intelligence, and maybe that takes over. So I think it's very likely that if you pick up a signal, it's not coming from some squishy protoplasmic little gray or green guy, that it's come from some machine.
In your most pessimistic moments, do you always believe that there is something out there?
Well, yes. I honestly do believe that there's something out there. Now, mind you, science is not about what I believe or what anybody believes. It's what you can prove with the data, of course. But, you know, the planet hunters will tell you, if you ask them straight out, look, you guys have found, you know, what, 400 planets or something like that. If you had a perfect instrument, if you had perfect telescopes, what fraction of stars do you think would show that they have planets? And they'll tell you, well, maybe a half or three quarters, which is essentially all. So that means they're on the order of a million planets in our galaxy. And while most of those might not be terribly attractive, it's hard to believe that in a million planets that they're all unattractive. I mean, you know, even at the College of Medusa, there were a couple of, you know, nice-looking women. So I really do think that that they are out there. What is less clear is that that they are making themselves known in a way that we can find. I mean, we don't know that, and it may be that SETI will not succeed, not because there isn't anything to find, but that we're not using the right strategy.
Talking of technology, actually, just since the example you mentioned from 12 years ago where you had that false alarm, since then, planet hunting technology, the satellites that do this, it has exponentially improved. The number of planets we're discovering every year is in the hundreds now. It used to be ones every few months. But now the groups at Berkeley and other places, they're just discovering them every day, it seems. And the telescopes themselves are getting better. If you believe the Europeans, they'll be building telescopes within 30 years that can image the atmospheres of other planets. So in the next 10 or so years, we might have amazing technology that can map hundreds and hundreds of planets. Does this give you confidence that we're going to find it sooner than you thought, perhaps?
Well, I, you know, that would be okay by me. But I think what it will do, and in particular, you didn't mention, but one of these planet hunting schemes is that of the NASA project Kepler. Kepler is going to do something different. It isn't just going to find another couple handfuls of planets.
This went up last year.
It went up indeed in 2009. And the deal is that by 2012, in other words, in the next couple of years, the next 3 years, this telescope will answer the question, what fraction of planets out there are sort of like the Earth, where they kind of liquid oceans, you know, thick atmospheres and so forth, be the kind of places you might want to go on holiday. So we don't know the answer to that. And that's a profoundly different kind of thing. That's sort of like what happened in the first 30 years after Christopher Columbus, when the Europeans mapped the globe. If you tried to, you know, draw a globe in 1491, you know, you'd have Europe, you'd have Africa, you'd have, you know, India, a little bit of the Far East, and that's it. Big chunks of the globe would be completely blank. Within one generation, that was changed. It only took one generation to do that. The previous generations couldn't have done that. Subsequent generations didn't have to do that. Exactly what's going to happen with Kepler. It's going to answer this question once and for all. What fraction of worlds out there are somewhat like the Earth? And, you know, we don't know what the answer is going to be, but the smart money is saying we're going to find that maybe 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 worlds out there is somewhat like our own world.
Do you think that there are any dangers involved in either looking for or finding ET?
No, I don't think so. A lot of people wonder about that. But remember, if you pick up a signal, you're just tuning in a radio signal. I mean, somebody tunes in their local radio station. There's no danger to them in having done that.
Depends what you're listening to.
Well, yes, it could be, you know, bad vibes. But, you know, but the station, in any case, doesn't know that you've tuned them in. And they're not going to send somebody to your house and hassle you. So, it isn't that the aliens will suddenly know that we're listening. However, there are possible dangers. If you reply and it turns out that they're hostile, you know, you reply, they get the reply, and they send the missiles to wipe you out for who knows what reason. This all sounds paranoid to me, but I mean, there are people who seriously say this is a possibility. Honestly, if you think that, then you should shut down the BBC tomorrow, right? Because after all, they've been broadcasting out into space for a long time now. There's that very, to me, minuscule danger. The other possibility, which I rate is somewhat more substantial, is that if you can understand them, then suddenly you're exposed to this very advanced knowledge. I mean, imagine you're a university academic. You've been researching some subject for, you know, 50 years, and these guys come in and say, oh, we solved that problem, you know, 50,000 years ago. Here, you may want to read some of our papers and kind of take the incentive out of your work.
One of the things that you discussed with AC Grayling recently was about the impact of this kind of work in his series of conversations about impacts of science. What is the impact of alien hunting to larger society?
Well, at the moment, it's pretty much restricted to TV specials or science fiction films in which the aliens come to Earth either to trash the planet or simply abduct you for these unauthorized experiments. So that's been the impact so far. Plus, of course, the fact that both in the United States and in Europe, Australia, Japan, approximately one-third of the population believes that the aliens are here and, again, engaged in these unsavory practices. But aside from the fact of being occasionally abducted, it hasn't had a big effect on our society, right? You don't see world problems being either worsened or cured by the aliens. So, it hasn't had a lot of effect. So those are the effects so far, all very superficial in my opinion. But if you were to find a signal, there are two possibilities. Either then you go back, you build a big antenna and you look for the message and maybe you can understand it. And it will undoubtedly be coming from a society far beyond our own. So maybe they could teach you enormously interesting stuff. I mean, imagine that you can understand a society that's 1,000 or 1,000,000 years more advanced than ours. I mean, imagine what you could learn. That's a possibility. It seems kind of far-fetched, but maybe. The second thing, though, this is for sure, if you find the signal, that at least you know that Earth is not some sort of highly singular miracle. This is, not the only game in town. And I think philosophically that will play a big role over the long term.
Science Weekly.
That was a lovely and meandering chat with Seth Shostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute in California. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's where there's also a link for you to subscribe so you don't miss an episode ever. You can join our Facebook group. We've just hurtled past the 1,500 members mark. Search Twitter for Science Weekly as well. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, who's currently on his way to Australia. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Next week, not sure to be honest, but should sound a bit more like what you're used to. Happy New Year, one and all.